All right. We'd like to welcome everybody out to the RAC meeting tonight. As of right now, we don't have enough for a quorum, but we're hoping that we'll have a couple more show up and we'll be able to have a vote. If we can, let's have the approval of the agenda. Good point. I do that every time. I did it last time too. Same with the minutes and everything. No quorum.
Yeah, we got two meetings worth of minutes we haven't approved.
We have a backlog. Then with that, I can give a little bit of an update on the wildlife board. It was pretty, as far as wildlife boards, it was quite an easygoing wildlife board, but there was one change that the wildlife board approved from what was presented by the DWR, and that was on the possession limit. There was quite a bit of discussion at the wildlife board, and quite a bit of public input, and there was a lot of concern from the public that the DWR's proposal that the possession limit pertained to cutthroat trout. There was a lot of comments that, what if people were fishing in Wyoming, or if it was their wife's fish or someone else in their family, how would they know that possession limit in the freezer pertained to them? And so there was a lot of discussion that way, and probably quite a bit of good discussion and provoked a lot of thought, I felt, through the meeting. And at the end of the day, they ended up voting no possession limit. The proposal would have been for, all species except trout, and it ended up just going with no possession limit.
So the division was, when they weren't going to include trout, they were going to do some kind of a study to determine whether it would affect populations. Are they going to continue that study regardless of whether it's...
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure they are. I don't remember the specifics, but I'm sure we'll be monitoring that very closely, because that was the concern, that the resource loss on trout, if that was the case. And so,
I believe that was a big thing. Anything else that you have?
No, that's basically just the meeting. It was pretty quick. Or yeah. It was a quick RAC last time, too, if you remember. So tonight's going to be a little longer, I think.
And yeah, and we didn't have a quorum last meeting, but they did take our comments very well. So with that, regional update.
Okay. Okay, good evening. It might be a long meeting, so maybe I'll just make this pretty short, but we've had a very busy fall, all of our sections doing a lot of great work. Our aquatic sections, to start us off with, they've been gill netting at the various reservoirs on the Manti. They do this twice a year. It gives an indication of what's in the reservoirs and how big the fish are, what kind of species are in them. No big surprises on most of the reservoirs that we surveyed. The big surprise was a mammoth, though. If you can see that on that list there, they found chubs at mammoth, which was pretty disappointing. And the only way chubs have got there, of course, is by anglers moving them there. So previous to this year's survey, we hadn't seen chubs at mammoth, and so that was disappointing to see. But the other reservoirs went really well, saw some big fish and the types and sizes and species that we wanted to see. So they've also been working with our law enforcement section to do checkpoints for quagga mussels. They've been doing checkpoints both in Hanksville and down working the ramps as well. We had two check stations in October. One check station that we had, I know the officers and biologists are really disappointed with the boaters that came out of the Lake Powell. A lot of them hadn't drained their boats, didn't know how to drain their boats, weren't real knowledgeable on the AIS issues, and it was really frustrating to see that this many years later, after this much education, that there was still that many people who didn't know or claimed to not know what was going on. So we wrote 20 citations. Hopefully it was just a bad weekend and doesn't represent what's going on, but Lake Powell will continue to be a huge focus for our law enforcement and our aquatic sections for years to come. This winter, we're working with the National Parks. It looks like they're going to give us their federal money, and we will hire a bunch of seasonals next spring and summer, to work, to live down at Bullfrog and to work ramps and check stations throughout the entire summer and spring, summer, and fall. So we're still trying to figure that out. There's a statewide committee that's been formed as well, and together they're going to make recommendations. There might be some legislation that we propose and try to get someone to run through the legislature that will add resources and funding to this program. Brent and Walt and everyone else in our region who helps them out have been busy the last few months. We had a mule deer watch at Nash last weekend. It wasn't as well as attended as previous years. It was the day after Halloween, which might have played a role. Was a little earlier in the season than we normally have it, but they were still able to see some deer. I think in future years they might consider pushing that date back a weekend or two as well. So then this last weekend they had a 3-gun shoot. So I guess the mule deer watch was 2 weekends ago, and this last weekend they had a 3-gun shoot in the town of Emory, and they had about 60 people attend. And so it had a really good turnout. The 3-gun shoot's been a real popular event. I know Walt wants to take it to all the different counties in our region. He's done several so far, but you'll be seeing 3-gun shoot events in the future. On December 6th is our Bighorn Sheep Watch. We do this every year. It'll be here in Green River. And Brent will be working with the media to put out press releases on times, and you have to call Brent to sign up for that. This is the time of year the habitat section is the busiest. They've been doing habitat work on all of our, a lot of our WMAs, but also on private and state and federal lands also. This year we're working with our partners, the BLM, the Forest Service, the NRCS, sportsmen groups, forestry, fire, and state lands, you know, all of our the government agencies and conservation groups in Utah to implement habitat restoration projects. Anything from lowland riparian up to high elevation aspen, and everything in between is what we're targeting and restoring. A lot of the species are, you know, big game, mule deer and elk, but we also develop projects and implement projects that benefit sage grouse and migratory birds and waterfowl and all sorts of species. So there's a few projects listed there at the bottom, but we're really working in all counties. We have habitat projects. And then those top pictures there, Brent creates these PowerPoints every month, by the way. I wouldn't have put a picture of myself there, but at our Gordon Creek Wildlife Management Area, we have a historical town called Coal City, and there's some remains of what used to be Coal City. It's been up there since I guess the early 20s. But just recently we teamed up with our state parks and their graphic designer, and we put up some display panels and had a dedication service, so it was real nice. And then you might have seen some of these in the news. Law enforcement's been working really hard. Busy time of year for them as well. Kind of more notable cases this fall. The top left shows, three guys were fishing at Schofield. I think only one of them had a license. Anyways, there are 23 fish over the limit, and so that resulted in some fines and confiscated some fish. So we had a bobcat case. It was actually from last winter that was finished up in San Juan County. I think it ended up being a second-degree felony for that guy who took way too many bobcats. And then, of course, they're responding to calls and reports and doing a lot of investigations and writing citations where citations need to be written. And our law enforcement section has been, or our wildlife section has been busy as well. Right now they're doing bighorn sheep surveys. They've been in the helicopter for a few weeks now. They released over 100 scaled quail that we got from Colorado in San Juan County, hoping to enhance some populations down there. We also, our pheasant program is in full force right now as well. As an agency, we bought 11,000 roosters, and we've been releasing them throughout the state on our wildlife management areas and in walk-in access areas. And we started a few weeks ago at the opening of the pheasant hunt, and we'll continue throughout the pheasant hunt. Each weekend, we'll release more birds. So it's been a great opportunity. We've gotten a lot of positive feedback from our constituents about this program. They really, really have enjoyed it the last few years. I guess this is the second year we're doing it, so I think it's something we'll continue to see us do. And with that, I'll take any questions. Okay, thank you.
Wait, let me say one thing. I meant to bring my Accord and I forgot it, but I was going to show you on my phone and I hook it up to the computer, but the Division of Wildlife has a new app. So if you go to the App Store, both Android phones and iPhones, the app is compatible with both types of phones, and you can download this app for free, and you can download your licenses, you can look at fish and wildlife species and their different characteristics and state records on fish, and look at different walk-in access areas and WMAs. It's kind of a neat app that we're continuing to work on, but it's out for public use now, so look for that. At our next meeting, I'll actually show you some of the features of it. So.
Thank you.
Kent?
All right, thanks. So I'm Kent Hersey. I'm the Big Game Project Leader for the division. Tonight I'm going to be talking to you about the results of a hunter survey we did on mule deer hunters this past spring. So the purpose of the survey is we wanted to seek input from the hunting public about their preferences and opinions regarding deer management. And then we wanted to take the results of this survey, combine that with the input from the mule deer committee and provide it to the mule deer committee, and use that to help develop the 2014 statewide mule management plan. So what we did for this is we took a random sample of anybody who applied for or received a 2013 buck deer hunting permit, and then we stratified this group of people into six categories: those who were the dedicated hunters, those who put in for general season archery, general season muzzleloader, and general season any weapon, those who just put in for or hunted the limited entry side, and then those who put in for or hunted general season and limited entry. So we met twice with the Mueller Committee, once in April, once in May, and we provided them an outline of the survey we did in 2008, and then we went over every question with the committee and tweaked them, deleted them, revised them, whatever, and we came up with a product that we all felt was good at getting at what mule deer hunters in Utah wanted. Then we took and sent an email invitation to a little over 9,000 hunters, a random sample of them, and that was out of a total pool of nearly 141,000. And this was an internet-based survey that lasted about 15 minutes. Questions were primarily rating their agreement with a certain statement questions, yes or no, or multiple choice. And then the survey was open for a three-week period, with a reminder being sent after 1 week and after 2 weeks. So overall, we got the return we expected. We had a 30% return a little over 2,600 total respondents. And what our goal was to get 400 in each one of those six categories. So we got, that would have been 2,400. We got 2,600, but we did fall a little bit short with the dedicated hunters only had about 380, and then another category only had about 365. So we weren't quite at our exact goal for all of them, but we were certainly close enough to make some good inference. And then we took all the results and we weighted them by the percent of applicants of each group, and that allowed us to put it into one result to see what the mule deer hunters in Utah wanted. So moving on to the results of what we actually saw, and the questions I'm going to present on the slides tonight aren't all the questions. I just focused on the ones that were most pertinent to the mule deer plan. I think what you did get in your packet did have all the questions. This is kind of just a truncated version for the sake of time. First question is one we ask on most of our surveys, and that's, why do you hunt? excuse me. And being with friends and family was the highest rank, and that's usually what we see. That was followed by harvesting a large antlered buck, putting meat on the table, getting away from the usual demands of life, being close to nature, and bringing back pleasant memories. So of these six responses, five were social aspects of hunting, showing that is an important component. Interestingly, the harvesting a large antler buck normally ranks a lot lower than this. In this survey, it was second, so indicating that clearly is important to a group of people. Next question is dealt with their hunt satisfaction. So we asked them how were they satisfied if they harvested any buck regardless of size. 55% of the people disagreed with that statement. We then asked whether they were satisfied with their hunt even if they didn't harvest, and about half the people said that that's a true statement. And then we took that same question, added a little to it, and said, are you satisfied without harvesting as long as you see bucks? And 70% of the people indicated that. So when you take all these questions combined, you know, it basically indicates that people don't need to harvest to have a good hunt, but they do want to feel like they have an opportunity. They want to see some animals and not just be out there on a camping trip. Another question we ask on most of our surveys is about hunter crowding, and yet again the answer was similar to what we see in the past. About half the people indicated that they did feel crowded sometime during the hunt. About half who hunted indicated they didn't. So it's almost always about a 50-50 mix there. Next questions dealt with their satisfaction with the number of bucks they saw and the size they saw. Both situations, a little over 60% of the people indicated that they were dissatisfied with this. So we followed that up with asking whether they were interested and willing to accept additional restrictions in order for us to manage for bigger, large antlered bucks, and 70% of the people indicated that yes, they were. We provided them after that with four possible options that we as a division could realistically implement to help improve the number of bucks on the landscape. And the first was converting our general season units to limited entry managing for a higher buck doe ratio. 45% of the people said they did not like this option. About a third said they did. Second option was to convert tags into archery and muzzleloader from the rifle, so lowering percent success and saving bucks out there. Again, 45% said they didn't like it. About a third said they did. We could have road and trail closures during the hunt, making it harder to get to the animals, lowering success. Half the people did not like this. A little over 30 did. And then the fourth option was giving up hunting every year. And nearly 50% of the people said they didn't like it, and again, 33% said they did. So for all four options that we gave them, even though 70% said they were willing to take additional restrictions, the four choices that we gave them that could help, nobody seemed to like that. Next set of questions dealt with our current management and what they wanted to see. So we gave them the current distribution of all our units. So we have 30 general season, 7 limited entry, and 2 premium limited entry. and we asked whether they'd like to see no change in those, fewer or more of those units. So we'll start with the red here, that's premium. 60% of the people indicated they liked where it was. Only about 15 said they would like to see fewer, and a little over 20 said more. For limited entry, half the people indicated they liked how many we had. A little over 10 said fewer, and about a third said more. And then for general season, about 45 said they liked where it was, 35 or so fewer, and a little less than 20% more. So in all circumstances, the majority of the people liked our current situation the best. If there is evidence, there might be some people who'd like to see some more limited entry and fewer general season, if there is any attitude toward change. We next asked about our permit distribution. We currently are splitting 60% go to rifle, 20% archery, 20% muzzleloader. And again, in all three cases, the majority indicated they liked where it was. About 35 to 38% indicated they would like to see fewer any weapon in favor of more archery and more muzzleloader. At their satisfaction with our season length, we gave them the date for all 28s for archery, 9 and for muzzleloader, 9 for rifle. Overwhelmingly, the majority said they liked the current season lengths. There is a component that thinks the archery is a bit too long. For season timing, we listed the current time frames of that, and again, people are happy with the way we currently do it. And then, just specific to the rifle hunt, we asked whether they would be happy with a hunt shorter than 9 days, which is our current length, and they did not like that. And then we asked if they liked the hunt with only one weekend, and 60% of the people said they did not like that. So for these last two questions, it shows the importance of having our current situation, which is that Saturday opener for 9 days. That gives them both the 2 weekends and the 9-day hunt period. We next wanted to get their input on hunting deer and elk at the same time. This is something we've done in the past, and most people seem to like it, so we thought we'd try and see what current hunters thought about it. And about a third said they didn't like it, but a little over 40 indicated they did. So there is some support for that. And then we asked them about the possibility of hunting, providing limited entry hunting opportunity on our general season units, but doing this in early November. And about half the people indicated that this was a good idea worth exploring. So in summary, as we see with most of our surveys, social aspects play a large role in determining why people hunt in Utah. But that being said, there is certainly, although not the majority, there is a portion of the public out there who does want to see more large antlered bucks. Many hunters would like to see these bigger bucks. However, when we actually give them options to choose from, at least the ones we gave them, they didn't seem to like them, especially giving up hunting every year. And then overall, hunters do seem to be satisfied with the current management system. So I guess in conclusion, I think, you know, we took the results of this survey and used them quite a bit with the Mule Deer Management Committee. And I think when Justin gives his presentation next, you can see how we took the results of this and incorporated it into the new plan, and I think it turned out pretty well. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Kent, speaking firsthand of the survey, I had the opportunity to sit on the Mule Deer Committee. We actually kind of did it by committee. I was out of town on fire quite a bit this year, so Darius and Todd also attend the Mule Deer Committee. But speaking of the survey, I think it was very well put together, and I think the survey really helped guide the Mule Deer plan because of the survey, it, I think, was put together so well. You could really tell what the public was wanting. So thanks, Kent. Any questions from the rack? Questions from the audience? Please come up to the microphone and state your name. Yeah.
Kent Johnson from Green River, Utah. Hey, I had one question. You were discussing the survey you done of hunters, and in the survey you indicate, and this is what I found out from my own experience and talking with people and the fact that I hunt, is people like being in the field, but they don't necessarily have to kill a deer to enjoy themselves. Hmm. Most people are not going to want to give up hunting every year. One option, now I don't know how well it would work. I'm not a biologist and I'm not in your position. But one option that was not put before people as an option for restriction that they may support, and a lot of people I talk to and associate with would support an antler point restriction. And it seems to have worked out okay in Colorado. I've got friends over there that hunt and stuff, and they don't mind having an antler point restriction. They have it on deer and elk both there. And that gives people an opportunity, I think, to be in the field and be able to see more bucks, potentially. But according to your survey, they don't necessarily have to take a buck, but they like to be able to hunt every year and be in the field. Has that been addressed at all?
We certainly talked about it in the committee. I guess bottom line for that is we've tried it in Utah in the 80s, and almost every Western state has tried it. And I can't speak to your Colorado friend's experience, but generally speaking, most have deemed it unsuccessful. I mean, it seems like it's a great idea, but it hasn't really increased the buck doe ratio by a substantial amount, and the amount of illegal kill, and it's turning innocent hunters into criminals. It just creates a lot of hardship that we don't feel is a great option, and it doesn't. Okay. It's not a, from our perspective, it's not a panacea that it seems like a lot of people think it should be. Because you're actually putting so much pressure on your older age class bucks that you don't have the biggest deer out there that you think. I mean, most of what's left after the hunt is just yearlings. All the pressure goes on the top end, and it's just constant pressure up top. So the next year, instead of having yearlings, two-year-olds, threes, fours, I mean, most of your animals are just going to be yearlings and two-year-olds, and so then the pressure gets on those two-year-olds again. And so it actually creates a lot of law enforcement issues as well. What is legal? What's not? What do they do when somebody shot their first deer? It's got a little crab claw on the back. You know, makes them the bad guy if they take it, even though technically it's an illegal deer. So we have some real it's a lot tougher to implement.
Yeah, I just, I remember the antler point restrictions in the 80s and hunting during that time period. And, I was quite young then, and at times I was frustrated because I couldn't take bucks, but I enjoyed the hunt immensely at that time because you've seen a lot of bucks. Yeah. And I know it was a short-lived antler point restriction, so long-term, I don't know how it would have been, but...
Yeah, I think part of the reason that in the 80s that people think highly of it is we just had a lot more deer in the 80s. People could see a lot more.
Yeah, we did.
So,
I understand it was probably a law enforcement nightmare as well.
Yeah, we definitely had the increased illegal take was tremendous. Okay. And so
I was just wondering if it had been talked about. Or
we did. We definitely did talk about it.
I know Colorado's used it for a long time. Has there been any discussion with Colorado DOW about how well it's worked for them, or if it's been a good thing?
Generally, when you talk to biologists, they don't think it's the greatest thing. But I think in Colorado, they're doing it in conjunction with limited entry permits. And in that case, it's not really that necessary. It's when you do general season and point restrictions is when you see a lot of legal take. Generally, when you just have limited entry permits, people aren't taking a lot of these smaller deer anyway because permits are so limited anyway. So, but when you kind of combine the two, it's almost like it's a redundancy in management practices.
So Kent, one thing, at this mule deer committee, I would say we didn't, I think a lot of the people that were on the committee were familiar with the antler point restrictions, but the committee before, Anise actually provided a lot of input from several of the states, Colorado, New Mexico, Oregon, and we did have a lot of discussion, the prior committee, and it didn't seem to I mean, we did have a little discussion this time, but it didn't seem to be a real topic that the committee
never gained a ton of traction, so it didn't it didn't really warrant it as much. Yeah. But.
Okay. Thank you. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
So I'd entertain other questions, and please keep them at this time, questions to the deer survey. And then Justin will later be talking about the mule deer plan. Any other questions pertaining to the survey? Okay. Any comments from the RAC? Any comments from the RAC? I guess I didn't say public. Okay. Justin. As Justin's getting, there's a comment card up here on the table, and as we get into the, these action items, if you'll please fill your name out and what action item number you would like to address, and then on your comments, we'll take you at that time.
You can give me your comment cards.
Okay. My name is Justin Shannon. Tonight I'm going to present the statewide mule deer plan. Before I begin, though, I want to sincerely thank those that helped us draft this plan, the Mule Deer Committee. It was a very diverse committee. We had sportsmen, representation, Farm Bureau, landowners, public at large, universities like BYU and USU, federal land management agencies. It was really diverse. We had RAC representation, and Kevin, thank you specifically, and I know Todd and Darius filled in as well, which was a great addition. And a lot of these individuals spent a lot of time and commitment to helping us draft this plan, so I wanted to acknowledge them before we began. We held 9 meetings, ranging from the middle of April to the middle of September, and we spent almost 40 hours both on the survey and the details of the management plan. And so there was a lot of effort put into this. And how we went about this plan is we broke it up into three different sections. One was a population section, one was a habitat, and one was a recreation. And with each of those, we had goals, objectives, and strategies. So the goal for the population management section was to expand and improve mule deer populations throughout the state and within the carrying capacity of available habitats and in consideration of other land uses. So we had one objective for this goal, and that was over the next 5 years, we want to increase mule deer populations as conditions allow and bring all subunits, the unit populations to their unit objective, which is currently about 425,000. So if you look over the last 20 years or so, early 90s had a significant population decline in the state, and since then we've crawled our way out of it and dipped again and had some peaks and valleys, but right now deer are doing pretty well in the state. So the population strategies associated with this goal and objective is to conduct annual browse assessments to ensure that habitat can support current populations. Also on units that are chronically below objective and where habitat is not limiting, one, to manage predators according to the current predator management policy. We also wanted to implement research to identify and protect migratory corridors. That was very important to the committee, and we agree. And then also, in addition to antlerless harvest, we want to continue using translocation as a management strategy. And I just want to point out, this is not every strategy under the population section. There's quite a bit. There's a bunch of them that were in the packet, but what we wanted to highlight is that these are just some of the big ones that we spent a lot of time discussing and kind of give a tone for that section. So moving along with translocation, last year at this time, we proposed a bunch of release sites statewide, and as we revamped the statewide plan, we wanted to include 6 new additional release sites. One is the Raft Rivers on the Box Elder unit, Hardware Ranch, Cedar Hollow on the Camas unit, Horse Ridge and Lake Canyon on the Aviniquin, and then the Browse area, which is in the Pine Valley in southern Utah. For the habitat goals and objectives, we wanted to conserve, improve, and restore mule deer habitat throughout the state with an emphasis on crucial ranges. This goal has two objectives. The first is to maintain mule deer habitat throughout the state by protecting and enhancing existing crucial habitats and mitigate for losses. And the second is, over the next 5 years, to increase the quality and quantity of vegetation and treat 500,000 acres throughout the state. That's important habitat for mule deer. So again, some of the strategies that we highlighted for this presentation are to identify and rank threats and limiting factors within each unit. We also want to continue to support and provide leadership for the Utah Watershed Restoration Initiative. Wanted to emphasize improving sagebrush, steppe, aspen, and riparian habitats. Continue to support the big game range trend studies. And then use acceptable guidelines for mitigating energy development. Moving on to recreational goals and objectives. The recreation goal is to provide a diversity of high-quality hunting and viewing opportunities for mule deer throughout the state. The first recreation objective is to maintain a hunting program for mule deer that encourages a variety of quality hunting opportunities while maintaining population objectives. And the second objective is to increase opportunities for viewing mule deer while educating the public concerning the needs of deer and the importance of habitat and other limiting factors. We've got quite a few strategies that we'll go through, and I'll break them down one by one. One that's of great interest is how are we going to hunt these deer? And one of the strategies is to continue to provide three hunt unit categories, which are general limited entry and premium limited entry seasons, in approximately the current distribution to provide a variety of hunting opportunities. So starting with general season, we're recommending no change from the last plan. And part of this is because about 2-3 years ago, we broke up our general season into two categories. One was to manage for 15 to 17 bucks per 100 does so that we could provide opportunity on general season units. And then the other one was to manage for 18 to 20 bucks per 100 does so we could have a little bit more quality. And we wanted to ride that out for the next 5 years in this plan. Also, manage limited entry units for a 3-year average of 25 to 35 bucks per 100 does. Again, that's similar language to the last plan. On premium limited entry, there are some differences. The new strategy is to manage premium limited entry units for a 3-year average of 40 to 55 bucks per 100 does, with greater than 40% of harvested deer being 5 years or older. And the way that that's different than the last plan is over the past 5 years, we've managed for 40 to 50 bucks per 100 does, and we've increased that by up to 40 to 55 bucks per 100 does. So a little bit more quality on the buck to doe ratio. And then also, the way it worked before was 40 to 55% of the bucks had to be 5 years or older. And if we were exceeding that, we would recommend an increase in tags. If we were below that, we'd recommend a decrease. And what we're proposing tonight is to do away with the 55%. So it's just greater than 40% of the bucks need to be 5 years or older. With that, we would set a baseline permits for the public draw, and that would be recommended at current levels, similar to what we had last year. And then we want to continue to provide management buck hunts to provide additional hunting opportunity with a minimum of 10 permits on each unit. We wanted to recommend permits for three weapon types based on the following percentages: 20% archery, 20% muzzleloader, and 60% any weapon. On some units, these percentages may be altered in order to help us achieve minimum buck-to-doe ratio objectives. We have some units in the state where we keep cutting permits, and we're still not getting to our minimum objective of 15 bucks per 100 does because the harvest success rates just continue to increase. And so on units like that are very rare, we might get creative on our weapon splits. But generally, this 20-20-60 split is what we'll be recommending in the future. And to be fair, that's what we've been doing over the last 5 years as well. So, on appropriate limited entry and premium limited entry units, we want to provide a multi-season hunting opportunity that will allow 3% of the hunters to hunt all seasons for an increased fee. This would be very similar to what we do for bear and elk right now. for those species are called premium permits. For deer, we're going to call them multi-season permits because we already have premium limited entry units, and it'd be quite redundant. So, want to establish season lengths that provide adequate hunting opportunity as follows: 28 days for archery, 9 days for muzzleloader, and 9 days for any weapon. There are a couple exceptions. One is, as we have deer and elk hunts, seasons that may overlap during this plan, that may vary from 9 days. The high country buck hunts that we used to have, where we're taking advantage of deer that are leaving Utah, or in some cases, like the Dolores Triangle, where they're coming into Utah, again, we might vary from the 9 day season. Extended archery areas will certainly be longer, and then management buck hunts may be shorter. We're also proposing in this plan a strategy to explore hunting bucks in late October, early November on general season units to provide additional limited entry hunting opportunity. And areas that this would occur on are units that are being managed for 18 to 20 bucks per 100 does, and we would have to be exceeding those objectives in order to recommend that hunt. And the permits would be limited in number and would be part of the bonus point draw system. So even though these hunts would take place on general season units, you would use limited entry points because of the timing of the hunt. We also wanted to propose a strategy. And again, this isn't something we're doing tonight. It'll be part of the plan written just like this. But it's something we need to look at over the life of the plan, and that is to examine allowing hunters to harvest a cougar with their buck deer permit on units that qualify for predator management and where the harvest objective quota has not been met. And hunters would not be allowed to use hounds during that time. I'm not exactly sure what that would look like yet. We've got to have a lot of internal discussion and certainly take it back out for public review. But that's one of the strategies that we want to look at over the life of this plan. Again, we also want to investigate issuing a preference point to future first-time hunter education graduates. Again, something we want to look at over the next 5 years. We also want to explore additional opportunities to provide incentives to landowners that supply forage for mule deer. That'll be important. I think private lands are very valuable for our big game populations, and so we need to make sure there's a balance there. We also want to investigate consolidating the mule deer preference and bonus point system into a single draw system. There's a lot of discussion on the committee about this, and what this means is right now you can put in for a limited entry permit. If you don't draw it, you can hunt general season. And what this would do, as we look at it and potentially take it out for public review, would be that we have one point system, limited entry and general season. And again, that's something we'll look at over the life of the plan. We also want to provide hunting opportunities that will encourage youth participation and maintain family hunting traditions. So explore things like increasing the maximum group application size from 4 to 6, things like that. So in summary, this plan is going to provide guidance and direction for managing Utah's mule deer populations. And it's being proposed as a 5-year plan right now. The mule deer recommendations that we make and bring forth in the future will be made in accordance with this plan. And I can't thank the Mule Deer Committee enough for their efforts in drafting it. Kevin, I know you represent the Southeast Region RAC. Thank you very much for your efforts and the time that was spent. So that's our presentation. So thank you.
Well, thank you, Justin. Just to highlight a little bit, For those of you that are unfamiliar with how this plan works, Justin talked a little bit about how this committee is made up of a very diverse group of interests. And I just wanted to highlight a little bit of that. One thing that I can tell you is there's not one person in that committee that left and said, hey, I got every single thing I wanted out of that committee. Because if they did, then I would say the system would be broken. But the one thing with such a diverse group is I can say almost every person in there heard different ideas than what they had going into the committee. And I think at the end of the day, some of the ideas that they probably would have never thought of and ended up compromising and feeling like that they come up with a good plan. And I think that it was very well put together that way. And so thanks to the division for that. With that, any from the rack?
Justin, I think your slide, it was showing where the potential transplant areas were, and you had Aveniquin, Horse Ridge as a release site or something. Is that what that was?
Yeah.
What criteria did you use to select your transplant sites? How'd you come up with that list?
Yeah, I should have spent more time on that. So what we wanted to do was look at winter ranges that historically held more deer that we felt like can hold more deer currently. And we were looking for areas that wouldn't be depredation concerns. So we're not throwing these right in the middle of a nuisance or a depredation situation. And just areas that we felt could have higher potential for growth. So sagebrush that isn't overly hedged, area situations like that. And we took disease considerations into account as well. So, we're not wanting to pull these things or put them right in the middle of CWD and some of that stuff as well. So,
the reason that Aveniquin, I guess, red flagged my question is that area is also right adjacent to a large block of ute land. Is there any concern that we're building deer that we share with another entity that we have no control over how or what they hunt?
Yeah, there will be that potential, because as you put these deer out on the winter range, I'm not very sure where they're going to summer. I don't have good data on that. But what we do have good information on is we have done these transplants, and probably the thing that I'm most excited about is it seems like where we've released these things on the winter range, they've explored for summer and transitional, but they've came back to their winter range every year. Where they would be in hunting seasons and things like that for harvest, again, I'm not really sure. It's a good point. But they have been coming back to these winter ranges, which makes me think that they will be able to propagate in the areas that we release. So,
One question I have, Justin, is you talked about the 40% on the premium unit, mm-hmm. and then removing the 55% criteria. What effect will that have? And talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so essentially what we're doing is it looks like a pretty minor change, and it is. We're changing both of those. But last year, on the Henry Mountains, for instance, we were at 89% of our bucks were 5 years or older, and so the division came with a recommendation to increase permits, and it got shot down at multiple meetings. And so we were thinking, it seems like every year we end up coming to these meetings and we spend so much time talking about four permits on these units. And I think in the 5 years I was a wildlife manager, we had justification to increase every year, and we only increased once in those 5 years. So it was clear that there really wasn't the social appetite to increase permits on units like the Henrys and the Ponsagons. And so what we essentially looked at is said, okay, if the spirit of the Henrys and the Ponsagon is to have extreme quality, why put a cap on that? If they're exceeding 40% of the bucks that are 5 years or older, and if that number's higher than 40, are we okay with that? So that's kind of the justification. So really, what it means long term is we'll probably have less conversation at the rack and board meetings over these permits unless we fall below the set criteria. So.
Thank you.
That was what I was going to ask you too, so thanks.
Where you're going to select 3% of the hunters to, now I can't remember which system that was under, where they get a second opportunity, or a, no,
where they can
multi-weapon opportunity.
Yeah.
How is that going to be, like a an additional drawing, or how do you select the 3% of the hunters?
Yeah, it'd be similar to elk now, where how we do it for elk is you have archery, muzzleloader, early weapon, early rifle, late rifle, and then there's a fifth category called premium, and it's its own hunt, it's its own hunt number and draw, and we would do that same thing for deer. So
okay, so when they want to get into that program, it's like a whole separate unit they're applying for. They're not competing against every or
right. They're not competing with, like, say, the Any Weapon Hunters or anything else. You're putting in for that type of hunt.
Okay.
So my guess is it's going to be more difficult to draw, but you can hunt all three seasons for it. So
now on that multi-season hunting opportunity, was it for? I mean, is every general season? Or was that just the 18 to 20s?
Yeah, it won't be general season at all. So maybe I wasn't very clear on that. It would just be for limited entry and premium limited entry. And the reason we're not going general season is because we already have the dedicated hunter program where they can – there's avenues to hunt like that on general season. Okay. So
that's for limited entry. Okay.
It would be take the Buck Cliffs, for instance. Yeah. You could potentially hunt archery, muzzleloader, any weapon.
Well, you said you're going to explore incentives for landowners that provide habitat for mule deer. Is it going to be a committee? Have you thought that far into it? And when do you think you'll get started on that?
I think tonight, right, Scott? Is one of those presentations tonight on general season landowner deer issues? Yeah. You'll see one thing later on tonight, but it doesn't mean that we're stopped there. It's just the intention behind that was private lands are really important for many of these mule deer populations, and so we got to make sure that we're doing things that allow landowners to increase tolerance for deer on their properties. So, but one of the things will be presented tonight. So.
Okay.
So with that, we'll entertain questions from the rack. And so at this time, please come up to the microphone. And this is just for questions for the mule deer plan. And then afterwards, if you do have comments, please bring your yellow card up to Chris. But right now, just questions. Please state your name as you come up.
One quick question on this late buck or November hunt on the deer. Is there anything in the rules that are going to prevent landowner tags from going into that late season hunt?
What do you mean landowner tags?
If the person buys a landowner tag, they pick the season that they choose to hunt.
Right. No.
Is this going to be accepted? And are you sure that it will be not available, they go into that late season?
No, this will be for the public draw. So this isn't...
Okay. The thing is this was mistaken once, thought it was that way on the Book Cliffs and ended up with landowner tags. Everybody hunted a late season on there. Just want to ask and make sure that there is something documented that they can't choose that hunt, because that could very much go way beyond what your plan numbers or permits would be.
You're talking for landowner association permits, those types of things?
Yeah.
I don't foresee us going that way, no.
I guess the question is if a person buys a landowner permit, is that late season going to be one of their options?
No,
to hunt?
Not currently, no.
Okay, I just clarify that isn't going to be an option.
Yeah.
Please state your name.
Kent Johnson again, Green River. In your management strategies, you had an option just fielded for allowing the deer hunters to take a cougar during their hunt on specific units. I was just curious, why wasn't bear explored as one of those options? I'll give you the LaSalle Mountains as an example where I hunt quite a bit. bear are out of control on that mountain. You go there, if you go during the archery deer season, I can promise you there will be days you see more bear than you do deer.
Yeah. Yeah, fair question. The reason that we went with mountain lions instead of bears is that the mule deer committee, as we talked about limiting factors for deer, that I think cougars have more of an impact on kill rates than bears do. And we have a lot of literature to show that. And the other part of it is mountain lions are an obligate carnivore, meaning they have to eat meat to survive, whereas bears, even on areas like the La Salle's, if you have a good berry crop, if you have a good acorn crop, things like that, they have other alternatives. And so this was a way to say, looking at harvest objective units, have we reached those quotas or not? And if not, could we open that door and extend some of that opportunity for deer hunters? And so bear, if we wanted to get more aggressive with bear, we could just certainly increase more bear permits. But on mountain lions, we have quotas set, harvest objective quotas, and sometimes they never get filled. And so this was just a way to provide a little bit more opportunity. So,
well, yeah. I don't know about you, but when was the last time you seen a lion just wandering around on the mountain?
Probably about 2 years ago.
It's been yeah. about
but it was
15
pretty rare.
Years
yeah.
since I just stumbled yeah. across a lion.
Yeah.
And we have good numbers of lions. So, you know, I would question the effectiveness of that.
Sure. Yeah, I mean,
and I can show you a picture I took during the deer hunt this year of a bear on a kill.
Right. Yeah. Justin, I'm not disagreeing with you. You're going to see more bears and cougars.
So. Can I add? So next month is the bear rack, and you'll see our recommendations are going to be more aggressive towards bears statewide.
Okay. That was my question. Sorry I went on a tangent.
No, you're okay. And then one thing I would mention, even though the Mule Deer Committee, that we didn't recommend that. If that is a recommendation from the public tonight for the rack to consider, you know, that's what this meeting is for those recommendations. So, any other questions, Troy?
Troy Jessenson, Sportsman Fish and Wildlife. In reference to Guy's question, Justin, I believe that late season is only pertaining to general season, correct? We're not talking about limited entry, the muzzleloader season.
Yeah, that's only. Oh, I'm sorry.
So,
yeah.
So I think it wouldn't apply. But I think what he's getting at too, and we would support also, that on that one, that the multi-hunt deal to where you're allowed to hunt all three seasons, we ask the same thing, that it only apply to those people who draw and not landowner permits or conservation tags. So I think
that's what I want to make sure.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood you.
Landowners aren't going to be eligible to have one of them as their choices.
Right, because Troy's right, just to clarify. So when we're talking managing for 18 to 20 and you have that muzzleloader hunt, the landowner associations don't apply in that instance because we only have landowner associations on limited entry units. And that's general season, so that wouldn't apply. And I think, Troy, what you're talking about is as we have the multi-season permits, that those wouldn't apply to landowners.
Both of them.
Okay. All right, sorry about that.
No, good. Any other questions from the audience? Comments from the audience?
Troy Justin, Sportsman, Fish and Wildlife. It's always good to come to Green River and eat at Ray's, so that's good. So, now, on behalf of SFW, we'd just like to thank everybody that participated in this committee. We appreciate the time and effort they put into it, and as a whole, we support the plan that's been presented. Thank you.
Thanks, Troy.
Guy Webster, I comment just make sure that landowners' permits are not going to be able to do that. Any landowners, whether it's a cooperative landowner or a private landowner that just gets one or two permits, that they're not eligible. Also, one other comment on the lion thing, I do think that you do potentially open yourself up to a big problem. Most of deer hunters aren't educated in knowing the harvest objective system with lions, knowing how to check, see how many lions are available. You do have a possibility you got some deer hunter on the mountain for 9 days, even if he did call the first day or two and then the that unit is filled. He takes a line after that quota has been met. You're opening up a law enforcement nightmare to where he's obviously violated the law to take that line. Any deer hunter that wants to take a line, they're eligible to go buy a harvest objective line permit, and they already have that opportunity. So if they're serious about doing it, they've already got that. Thank you.
Thanks, Guy. Any other comments from the audience? Thank you. Comments back?
The only comment I have is we just heard that the Mule Deer Management Plan wants to explore landowner incentives, and yet I just heard several people or a couple people stand up and want to make sure that the landowner tags aren't qualified for some kind of a program that might be a better opportunity kind of thing. So I just curious on whether that discussion came up at the management plan committee meetings and what kind of solution or why we resolved it at the explore incentives, but yet it sounds like the public is not that big on it.
Yeah. So I'll take a little stab. So some of it was in two separate discussions. One of the big topics was Nevada has a landowner incentive program that's really kind of taken off and done really well. It's recognized that the landowners that are accepting of the big game, and so a lot of that discussion came from some of the landowner representatives on the group. But in doing so, in this discussion with this multi-season, I don't recall, Justin, that we really had any discussion as that as being an option for the landowners. I don't think it came up as a topic.
No, nor do I. I don't remember saying let's do this or not do this based on landowners getting a permit. It just really didn't come up. What we wanted to do was model this similar to how we do elk right now. And with the elk rule, with that portion of the rule, when it comes to these landowner or premium tags for elk, multi-season permits for elk, landowners associations aren't eligible for those. And so we were thinking to model the deer similar to the elk because that was what we told the committee we were going to do. So.
And one thing to note, the Mule Deer Committee wasn't really comprised of probably the right group of personnel or experience to address this landowner issue. So although we did see a need for it, those ideas and especially the product did not come from the Mule Deer Committee, only just an idea and need for it, and then I believe that it came from the division.
So. Yeah, and towards the end of that committee, there was a lot of things like conversation like, does the committee think this is a good idea? Yay or nay, and if they did, then they'd say, division, explore this, because you're going to have to take a lot of this back out through the public process anyways. And Kevin's right, it may not have been the right makeup to say this is how we're going to address all the needs on a variety of strategies. So there was a lot of give and take and flexibility with the plan.
And any other comments from the RAC?
If we could.
Yeah. So with that, where we don't have a vote, I did appreciate at last meeting that I was able to at least give the Wildlife Board some direction from the group. Is there any real strong feelings that the group has that they'd like the Wildlife Board to know? Okay. I do just want to tell the division that I really appreciate the opportunity for the public input in this mule deer plan, especially in the amount of hours and time that went into the mule deer survey. I do really feel that the mule deer plan is a direct product of what the overall public want, and very much not what one individual group wants. And so I think that the public is well represented through that survey. So I thank the division for their time in doing that. With that, Bucks Bulls one.
Okay, tonight I'm going to present the Bucks Bulls once-in-a-lifetime rule changes, season dates, and boundary recommendations. So to begin, starting with general season deer hunts, essentially no changes from last year other than moving all the dates back one day to avoid a Sunday opener. The archery hunt would begin August 15th and end September 11th, muzzleloader September 23rd through October 1st, and the any weapon hunt October 17th through October 25th. For general season elk, your archery spike bull would go from August 15th through September 4th, and your archery any bull would extend a little further to September 11th. Any weapon would occur October 3rd through the 15th, and then your muzzleloader hunt October 28th through November 5th. I think the best way to give this presentation is to talk about the recommendations that have statewide implications that affect several regions or units, and then We'll go down into specific regional recommendations from there. So our first recommendation tonight is to provide limited entry deer hunting opportunities on general season units that are exceeding 18 to 20 bucks per 100 does. These permits would be limited in number and overlap with the muzzleloader elk hunt, which essentially runs from October 28th through November 5th. The units that we're recommending for this include Chalk Creek, East Canyon, Morgan South Ridge, Camas, Nine Mile, Pine Valley, Southwest Desert, and Zion. And this would require an update of the big game rule, which was part of your packet that had those changes in there.
Now, it doesn't say on there, but those are muzzleloader tags, right?
Yeah. The first bullet point is, they would be muzzleloader tags, correct. Yeah. Kyle, that's a good catch. Why is
that says it overlaps with the muzzleloader elk hunt, yeah, but it doesn't say it's a muzzleloader deer.
Good catch. It would be with a muzzleloader, yeah, because we wouldn't have a rifle hunt with a muzzleloader. And
right.
I may need to tweak that before the board meeting.
Okay. Thanks, Todd.
Our second recommendation is to provide multi-season hunting opportunities on limited entry and premium limited entry deer units. Hunters would be able to hunt archery, muzzleloader, and any weapon season, similar to elk and bears we've discussed. And the Crawford Mountains and Dolores Triangle, those are the two limited entry units that would be excluded just because one has a very specific weapon type already and the other has so few permits, it wouldn't qualify. And again, that would require Rule 657-5 to be updated. We recommend adding 3 hunt days to the limited entry muzzleloader elk hunt. The way this works is traditionally this hunt starts on a Wednesday and ends the following Thursday, but for this upcoming recommendation, we recommend starting on Monday, September 21st, and ending the following Friday, which would be October 2nd, and this would allow limited entry elk hunters more time in the field, closer to the rut, with less overlap with muzzleloader deer hunters. And if you look at what we've done for limited entry elk hunters, we've carved off a week closest to the rut where they don't compete with general season archery hunters. Archery elk hunters, and then when it comes to early rifle, we don't have competing hunts during that time frame as well, and so we just wanted to follow suit with the muzzleloader elk hunters and give them some time closer to the rut without all the general season muzzleloader hunts that are occurring as well in these mountains. So. We recommend extending season dates on mountain goat hunts. This recommendation will allow for longer and thicker coats on mountain goats. Season dates are in conjunction with access and road closures. And so essentially right now, most of these mountain goat hunts end October 12th, I think, this year. And on some of these, we want to extend them to late October and in some cases late November. And these season dates aren't just arbitrarily chosen. They're chosen based on when agencies like the Forest Service would close their gates or limit access. And we didn't want to go beyond that to give hunters the expectation that they can actually get to some of these areas if access is going to be an issue. So. Additionally, we recommend updating the big game rule to prohibit using drones to take big game. We also recommended allowing unsuccessful limited entry deer and elk archery hunters to hunt extended archery areas. We also wanted to correct a clerical error, which clarifies which permit allows a youth to hunt archery muzzleloader in any weapon season. Essentially, when we went unit by unit, we had certain permits that would allow, say any weapon hunters. If you drew in any weapon permit, you can hunt all three seasons. But that wasn't the case if you drew a muzzleloader permit. But our rule, there was a lack of alignment between what we were doing and what the rule was saying, and so we wanted to clarify that moving forward. We also want to add moose to the CWD and importation sections and just other minor corrections and clarifications throughout. So now moving on to regional recommendations. For the southern region, we recommend splitting the Zion bighorn sheep hunt into an early and a late to reduce crowding. Each of these would be roughly 30 days. We also wanted to
add,
what's that?
What is that season now?
Right now, it's about September 12th to November 10th. So it's about
so
a two-month season.
Kind of divide it in half.
Yeah, just cutting it in half. Yeah. We also wanted to recommend adding a muzzleloader pronghorn season to the Southwest Desert Unit. For the Southeast region, I recommend adding an archery hunt for pronghorn on the LaSalle, Potash, and South Cisco Unit. In the Northern region, we recommend splitting the Newfoundland Mountain bighorn hunt into an early and a late, which are at least 3 weeks, October 24th to November 13th. And November 14th through December 6th. We recommend adding an extended archery deer area on the west cache to address urban deer. We recommend adding a limited entry deer hunt on the North Slope Summit, which is Unit 8A, that runs concurrently with the general season elk hunt, which is October 3rd to the 15th. And in the past, what we had was something called high country buck hunts, and this is just reestablishing those. And it's in this part of the state, we have deer early October, mid-October, they're leaving into Wyoming. And so we wanted to structure a limited entry hunt to allow hunters to harvest some of these bucks before they left the state. Also recommend adding a muzzleloader pronghorn hunt on the Cache, Morgan, South Ridge, and Ogden unit, and then discontinuing the Pilot Mountain bighorn sheep hunt for this year. Central region recommendations. Recommend discontinuing the San Pete Valley extended archery elk hunt because of the conflict of harvesting limited entry bulls with over-the-counter permits. We also recommend changing the boundary of the Wasatch elk unit to exclude areas that fall within the Wasatch front extended archery unit. The season dates for the extended archery hunt will run from August 15th to December 15th, and this extended archery area will remain a limited entry unit to allow for spike hunting in areas like Summit County. And then also we want to slightly alter boundaries of the Ochre Stansberry and West Desert Deer and Elk herds. The Northeast region, no regional recommendations, no changes. Some key dates that we want to keep you aware of that we present every year is the big game drawing for bucks, bulls, once in a lifetime. Lifetime license holders and new dedicated hunters would be January 29th through March 5th. And then if you're applying for a bonus point or preference point or a withdrawal, that goes to March 19th, and then the results will be posted at the end of May. Additionally, some key dates for our hunters with disabilities for general season hunts. Essentially, it's 5 days prior to the time hunts begin, and in some cases, a few days after as well. So. But that's our presentation tonight. Thank you.
Thanks, Justin. Questions from the RAC?
As the reason for discontinuing the hunt on Highland Mountain is the numbers down, is that?
Yeah, that it is. They were up a few years ago, and so we were able to have a couple more tags there. But on years like this where the ram counts are down, the numbers are down, mm-hmm. we share that mountain sits right on the Nevada border. And this year it's where we only have one permit. They get the permit this year, and if we have a hunt next year, we'll get the permit next year. So,
Justin, on the list of units that qualify for that late season limited entry on general season, mm-hmm. I noticed that a lot of them are northern region, pretty much private, a lot of private land, CWMU. Yeah. Is there... Being it takes a general season tag, I assume the CWMUs won't be eligible for any late season. So it would be just general season tag holders who had some friends that had some private land that wasn't in a CWMU that they could hunt the late season.
Yeah, that's one scenario. Another scenario is we have some wildlife management areas up there that winter a bunch of deer. But during the rifle hunt, there's not a lot of deer on them, and so giving them time for deer to come off some of these lands onto publicly owned lands or other public lands that may be up there, or even smaller landowners that really aren't set up or qualify for the CWMU program, I think all those scenarios they could take advantage of this.
I'm interested to the one unit I'm familiar with is the 9 mile. Unit. I'm not familiar with the northern region units that much, but my guess is that the landowners or CWMU operators that are trying to build quality on their areas and then their deer move down to the winter range and get the quality gets skimmed off by these late season hunts is going to be it's going to be hard to meet your objective of explore landowner incentives when the landowners are trying to build quality that a newly formed hunt to kill the bucks that they're growing on their private land kind of thing is. Is there any? Am I way off base on this, or is there going to be some repercussions?
I think it's point of view and perspective, because if you're a smaller landowner and you neighbor one of these CWMUs and they get to hunt all these big deer, but then all these deer come in winter on you and you don't get the same opportunity, then I think there's some frustration there if you're the smaller landowner. But I get your perspective if you're the CWMU operator. The reason I'm very comfortable with this recommendation in this hunt is right now CWMUs, they get to hunt till November 10th. And with this, the public hunters don't. Public hunters are essentially done the end of October. And so we're allowing CWMUs to have these extended hunts. And so if the deer are really on these CWMUs, the CWMU hunters will have that opportunity. Whereas if they're off by the first week in November and on these other smaller properties, what's the harm in letting public or other private landowners that may be smaller get this same opportunity? And really the other thing, too, that we're trying to avoid is on a unit like the 9 mile where we have 1,300 permits, we're still over that $20 per 100 does. And we've heard it come up, why don't you just issue more general season permits? And in some cases, you may be over swamping this with hunters. I mean, there's only so many that can be held. And so having a later hunt allows that buck to doe ratio to lower and give a pretty good opportunity. So
yeah, although my guess is if I was to ask Brad where most of his classification occurs, it's going to be on private land behind locked gates, and that's why the buck doe ratio is high as it is. On public lands, mm-hmm. if he were to separate his classification and just use the buck doe ratio that he does on public lands, you're not going to exceed your buck doe ratio.
Yeah. I think in other parts of the state you may. You really may, because there's so much private lands. And there's these WMAs, we build them for deer year round, And then there's very limited hunting opportunity, although there's a great, there's a ton of value for wintering them, which is great. I mean, that's really good. But we're just trying to do more for smaller landowners and public hunters that might be able to harvest one of these bucks that really is in excess anyways. If we're really trying to manage for 18 to 20 bucks per 100 does, this is an opportunity to get there without being overly aggressive and on some of these units.
So remind me again of how does a hunter get one of these late season tags? Is it going to be a drawing?
It would be no different than one of the other permits that you draw in for like a 9 mile archery.
It'll be a limited entry.
It would be a limited entry though. Yeah.
So you.
Yeah.
I'd have to pick whether I wanted to do a 9 mile range late hunt or a Book Cliffs limited entry hunt.
Correct.
With the same point system.
Yes. Yeah, so it'd be those points. So
lose your points and all that. I mean, it's just like another.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
But Darius, you're right. I mean, there's some people that may not like this. It's just we're throwing it out there for public input, because I think there's a lot of people that would see the value in being able to harvest some of these bucks that are over 20, and we're hoping that more people will like it than not, I guess. So.
Okay. And the Newfoundland hunt's getting split due to crowding issues on the Newfoundlands?
Yeah, there's essentially the one road on the north end, and there's that opening weekend, there's quite
many,
a few people.
How many tags they got up there now?
I think we're about 10 or so. Let me check. Do you remember, Troy, off the top of your head, how many we have?
I think you're right. I'm not
sure. Probably here somewhere. Yeah, 10 permits. So.
Any other questions from the rack?
I have a couple. One referring to the allowing unsuccessful limited entry deer and elk archery hunters to hunt the extended archery areas. This is just for information. What's the percentage of those limited entry deer and elk archery hunts that are unsuccessful? Meaning,
I think roughly, I could be off a little bit on this, but I think it's about 50 to 60% of archery hunters harvest on limited entry units. So just under half, I guess, are unsuccessful.
And then they'd be allowed to go to the extended archery if they so choose, I guess.
Yeah, and it hasn't been that way in the past. And we've had unsuccessful Book Cliff deer hunters call and say, how come I can't hunt the extended archery? It's open to everyone in the state but me. And it's really a social issue. We didn't have a good answer, so we thought we'd throw it out there for public comment and see what people thought.
And then I just had another question on the use of drones. What's the word for take? Meaning, are they using that to look for animals, or are they actually taking an animal?
Yeah.
It'd be pretty big. I don't know. I'm just curious on that.
Let me pull up the definition, because I will botch this.
Take or harvest. Or harass. Excuse me, it says harass on here. Take or harass.
It says a person may not take protected wildlife being chased, harmed, harassed, rallied, herded, flushed, pursued, or moved by any other vehicle, device, or conveyance listed in the subsection. So all those things would include take. So.
Okay. That's all the questions I had.
I can see the wheels turning with Todd there. You can't do it, Todd.
You got to define it, don't you? I mean, you got to say you can't use drones or somebody will try it.
With that, any questions from the audience? Comments? Okay. If you don't have your comments in, please bring them up. Troy Justison.
Troy Justison, Sportsman, Fish, and Wildlife. We support the division's recommendations for once-in-a-lifetime bucks and bulls. We'd like also to bring up two, and it was brought up in the central rack, is we have an expanding moose population that's moved down onto the Manti and also the Nebo. And so it was proposed down there that they extend the Wasatch unit to include both the Manti and the Nebo to allow the opportunity for those individuals to hunt those moose that are now finding home on those places. So, but you don't have a quorum tonight, so I don't know how you'll handle that, but it would affect this unit. But that's something we'd like to recommend and see go forward.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Troy. Guy Webster. Any other comments from the audience? Okay. Comments from the rest. One comment. I would just make a comment to Troy's. As far as the moose on the Manti and the Nebo, you know, those populations are quite small. We've had many discussions with the division about being on the really on the southern boundary of that threshold of what moose will use, and been a lot of discussion from the division of maybe it's temperature and tolerance and what they'll use, but those populations have never really have really taken off. And you know, it's very evident that it has nothing to do with the bull to cow ratio or anything like that on those populations. So I think it's good discussion. We don't have a quorum to vote on that, but I would open that up to those of you for your thoughts on that.
If the division is comfortable with that, my concern would be that if moose are trying to extend their range and we've got little subpopulations out there and there's one bull moose that gets shot and then we get five cow moose that don't get bred and we don't have calves out of them the next year, then to me that would be a problem. But if the division feels that the population is sufficient to withstand a harvest of a bull or two out in those outlying areas, I'm good with it.
If we could vote, I'd vote for it.
So that's, I guess, my input too. As I too would refer that this be done in conjunction with what the division's. I'd like to know their thoughts and insight, but just as an individual, I see this as, you know, not a lot of effort has gone into increasing those populations as of late, and there's probably an opportunity there in some places, and so you know, again, like Dare said, I'd like to see the division's involvement in that, but I'd like to see I'd like to see this go to the division and the wildlife board for further process. Any other comments to the other portions of the?
Again, if we could vote, I'd vote for it.
I too feel very comfortable with what the division's proposed. Big game preference point recommendations. Lindy Varney.
Changed. Thank you. My name is Lindy Varney. I am the Wildlife Licensing Specialist from the Salt Lake office. And I'm here to present a change to our preference point draw for general season buck deer draw. So I wanted to start off and give you the definition of what a preference point is. Preference points are designed to allow all applicants to draw a general season permit every few years. They work the best when there's more permits in larger areas, and we also don't have any waiting periods applied to preference points. So let me give you the background of when they started. They began in the year 2000, and at that time, a point was earned if you were unsuccessful for any choice, and you lost your points if you were successful on any hunt choice. This process was changed in 2009. A point was earned if you were unsuccessful for your first choice only, and you didn't lose your points if you drew out on your second through fifth choice. The reason for this change was to help reduce the remaining permits that were from the drawing that we would sell over the counter, to help remove potential for the system crashing, and to also fairly distribute our permits through the drawing. So I kind of want to show you the trend over the last several years of actually our leftover permits from the drawing. As you can see, back in 2006, we had over 26,000 permits remaining. And each year, it would slightly go down. But when we made the change in 2009, we went to 8,646 permits. So that's actually, we almost cut the permits in half from the year before when this change went into effect. And then from each year, we have cut permits by a couple thousand. But in 2012, we did have a little spike in remaining permits, and that's, we assume from the change to our 30 units before we had the five regions. And then from each year, we went down by 1,000 or so. I want to point out that in 2013, it actually was our first year to ever not have any rifle tags left over from our drawing. And also in 2014, we didn't have any rifle tags left over. And we actually only had a little over 2,000 permits. So the change that we made in 2009 actually gave us the results that we were striving for, to reduce the permits over the counter, to fairly distribute the permits, and help remove that potential for the system crashing. So this year, I wanted to kind of show you how our general season applicants applied for our general season deer permits. This year, we had 127,142 applicants. So as you can see, that 47% of those applicants actually only applied for one hunt choice. So that means they put down one unit, and if they didn't draw out, they didn't want a different hunt unit or a different weapon type. 21% actually applied for two different units. 12% applied for three different units, too. They would want to go hunt. 5% of our applicants applied for four different hunt choices, and 15% applied for all five hunt choices that we offer, that we allow them to. So as you can see, about 53% of the public apply for two hunt choices or more in our drawing. So based on the concerns expressed by the public over the current preference point system, the division is recommending a change so that all preference points are lost if a hunter is successful for any hunt choice. So I want to take a minute and kind of explain to you the concerns that have been expressed to us. What it is hunters have been calling us saying that people are drawing out on their preferred unit and then also receiving a preference point to use next year. And they didn't think that was fair, that if they drew, they should lose their points and brought back down to zero and be put so they can go back in the drawing without any points because they got the opportunity to hunt. So we are bringing this recommendation to address that one concern that the public has brought to us. If this does get approved, there are some pros and cons to think about. If it does go through, it would make it consistent with all of our other general season draws. So that means like our antlerless, our sandhill crane, grouse, and our swan drawings, because those are all preference points based draws. It would resolve the concern that I just talked about with hunters drawing a preferred unit and also receiving a preference point. There is the potential of more permits remaining over the counter. We're not quite sure if we would have more or how much more or how much less, just because we're not quite sure how hunters would actually apply if this change went through. So if we do have more permits, that means that we may have more pressure on our sales system on those big sales days, which in turn means that we'd have longer lines for the public to wait in at our agents and at our regional offices. It also include re-educating the public, letting them know that they would lose all their points if they drew out, no matter what hunt choice. And there also would be some more programming involved, which wouldn't be that big of a deal because we actually already do that with all of our other general season draws. And then some may think that hunters have lost their preference of what hunt and weapon type they want because they've been applying for several years and they want a preferred unit or weapon type. Because most things that we have seen is that people apply their first choice for a unit and their second choice is a different weapon type.
In the same unit.
Another recommendation that I'm making tonight is just some housekeeping changes to Rule R67-62. It was skipped that we have statewide archery permits, and we no longer actually have a statewide archery permit, so we need to strike out statewide. And we also need to add convention to the section that talks about waiting periods. If you draw it on a convention permit, waiting periods don't apply to the limited entry hunts, and that was skipped on accident, and we just need to put that in the rule. Thank you.
All right, so help me out here. We're in the drawing, and we go down the list, and I hit my name. You look at my first choice. If it's taken right now, then you look at my second choice. If it's not filled, I get that, but I still get the point because I was unsuccessful in my first choice.
Correct.
Okay. So you fill all, you just, and then if my second, third, fourth, I mean, clear down to my fifth, and so we're changing it so that my number comes up and my first choice is filled. Too bad, we're past you, going to the next guy. Till all the first choices are filled. And
no.
Then we start over on the second choices?
No, we're not. That's not our proposal at all tonight. What we're just changing is if you drew on your second through fifth choice, you would lose your point.
Currently,
the system, if let's say max points is 4, and you go into it and you have 4 points, within that point category, we look at everyone's first choice.
Okay.
Within that 4-point category. And then we look at everyone's second choice in that point category.
Oh, okay, I got you.
So right now we're just proposing to change that one little thing.
I got you.
And it'll put it back to the way it was in 2008.
Okay. I got you. Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
I clarified.
What precipitated, I assume you're getting complaints and that's why you're proposing this change, because it looks like from the division standpoint it works great from getting rid of the lines and over-the-counter sales. And
correct, yeah. It's more of a public concern, and it's a social issue that we just had so many people call in that we felt like it needed to be addressed. If we stayed the same, the division feels comfortable doing that as well.
So I assume the people that are calling complaining are the ones that just apply for one unit? 'Cause, I mean,
more than likely, yes.
And is there any sportsman organizations that have come as a group to complain, or is it just individuals?
It's been mostly individuals that have called us and talked about the issue, just because that's who, you know, I talk to on the phone most of the time is the public.
How many years, what's the maximum number of years that somebody would have to wait if they just applied for a one choice before they ever drew?
Depends on what weapon type. Right now, the longest it would be 4 years.
And in which weapon type is
that?
That'd
be your rifle plateau 1,000 length unit. I have this right here. Let me show you. This right here, this is for the 2014 and this draw. This means that if you had that point, you were guaranteed a permit for that unit. And as you can see, most units are 1 to 2 years, but most of them are 0 as well. That's your archery. Your rifle, like I said, 4 years for your plateau 1,000 lakes. But even a rifle, it can take 1 to 2 years, which is the purpose of a preference point system, is to let people draw every few years.
So 1,000 lakes is the only unit. 2 years is the maximum if you excluded Plateau Thousand Lakes.
Correct.
Seems like a non-issue to me.
Yeah. Unless you look right there, there's a 3 year, but that's for a non-resident for Southwest Desert. But that's because we offer a lower percentage of permits to them.
Any other questions?
That wrote to me, I say leave it alone.
Yeah. It seems to me the answer is that when they complain about us, tell them to put in for a second choice.
They have other choices.
Yeah.
Usually, though, on a second choice rifle, you probably wouldn't get that, though. I mean, they'd have to almost change the weapon, too. It's another choice to be more successful.
It depends on what unit you put in for rifle.
But you can.
But you could, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so just using the points that she has there, you can look at many of the units that
have zero.
That have zero, you may have very good possibility.
Right. I don't have any questions.
Questions from the audience? Comments from the audience?
Can I sit down? Or?
We drive together, so. Troy Justin, Sports and Fish and Wildlife. This has been something that's caused quite a stir amongst our group. And first off, SFW is not in favor of the proposed change. Instead, we'd like to see it that all first choices are awarded before we go to anybody's second choice. Then if you draw your second, third, or fourth, fifth choice, you do not lose your points. And the reason being is this, is a lot of people are putting in, hunting is a tradition. It's a family thing. We all have that one place we want to go, and so obviously that is your first choice. But then on the other side of it, you want to hunt. And so as kids, having children, you want to be there as a family. Well, okay, if we don't draw that, let's put it in here, we can just go here type deal. Now you're going to lose that, because if you put in for your second choice, you're going to lose those points, and those kids are never going to have the opportunity to catch up, really. They're going to go 3 or 4 years, possibly, to be able to go back and hunt where your family is. Those years aren't replaceable. You know, so our position as SFW is that we award all first choices first, and then go to the second, third, fourth down line, and then you do not lose your points if you draw anything but your first choice. Thank you.
So, question on Troy's proposal. How does that differ from the system we're in right now?
From what I gather, what Troy is saying is that we would evaluate everyone's first choice. Didn't matter how many points you had. Like, it would be kind of like with the limited entry draw system, where for how many points you get an application number, and then we take that lowest application number, and that's your draw number. That's how I take it, that he wants.
Well,
but right now,
wouldn't you do? Say you take your, first of all, you're going to take everybody in the say the 2 point. You're going to take all their first choices. If you got any left, you're going to go to the 1 point. Take all their first choices. If you got any left, you can go to the zeros.
And that's definitely a possibility. But that's not what I took that Troy was proposing.
Isn't that what you're?
Well, basically, I mean, you guys are smart me on this, but I think it would be similar to what's at once in a lifetime. You know, say you have 4 preference points, like Lindy points out. You're assigned 4 numbers, and your lowest number's entered in. And so if that number comes up, it goes to your first choice.
Right.
All right? If it's not filled, okay, then you get it. If it is filled, then you don't get it.
Yeah.
And so then you go through and you award everybody's first choice, and then go back through and you go to second choice.
Okay.
But are you talking about within each point category, or just, like you say, like once in a lifetime? We just assign random numbers to, if you have 18 points, we give you 18 random draw numbers, and then take that one. Or are you talking about within that 4-point category for preference points?
What's going to work best? You know better. Basically, what we want is all first choices awarded first before we go to second choice.
But you can't have a guy with 0 getting a tag ahead of the guy with 4.
That would
do.
Yeah.
Is that possible?
With the limited entry draw system, yes. With the preference point system, no.
Right. Okay. That's what I'm saying.
As it currently runs right now.
And I thought I was very familiar with how it runs now, but I'm totally confused now.
Do you want me to show you a picture?
Yeah, if you would.
Okay.
Let's run through what we are. If we didn't go with the tonight's proposal, what is the...
Okay, so currently, let's talk about right now. This is how our general season draw works. So let's take 4 points. That's why I keep saying 4 points, because that's my graph. Sorry. So right now, we are going to look at everyone's first choice within that four-point category, second choice category, third, fourth, and fifth. Then we move down to the third point, the three-point category. But within that four-point draw, there's actually another sequence that we, within that four-point range, we address as everyone's first choice first, then we go up to everyone's second choice second, and then everyone's third choice. That's what we currently do now. Yeah. And then if you draw on your second through fifth, you retain your points. You keep them. You only lose them if you draw on your first. Let me say out, though, only 9,039 people drew out a second through fifth choice this year out of 86,000 tags.
Okay. So now if I can look at this, the difference that Troy would be recommending, it would be the same for the first step, but the second step it would go through that whole point system instead of going down to their first, second, third, fourth, fifth.
The way I'm thinking that Troy is explaining, like I said, it's a lot more confusing than what you actually, when you think about it, you're like, oh, okay, makes sense.
Isn't Troy saying we do this screen first and then go to the other screen?
To the third, three-point category, then evaluate all their first choices. And then we do the second point range, all their first choices. Or do we, like I said, that's what I'm... And then we go up to the second choices and go down through all the point ranges. Then go up to the third and go down. You know what I mean? Like, you say that you want the limited entry draw, but we don't do this.
You want to do all the first, so you take the 4 points.
I'm going to have to go back and see exactly what my European... I'm the messenger.
Yeah. No, I know.
To be honest with you, I don't know for sure.
I've been giving this some thought.
So that's why they pay you the big bucks.
Oh, yeah. That's what happens when you give me the weekend.
Well, that's true. I don't know the answer to that. I don't.
So, okay, but like I said, that currently this is how it runs right now.
You want to do this first, go down all the first choices, and you go to the three.
Well, I would give this comment. For me, because I don't know that my brain's wrapped around all of that. But I would say that I like this better than the proposal that come tonight from the public. I think that there is some real great reward in the family being able to use those second choices to be able to hunt together and so many things. I would not want to lose that. But I don't want to. There may be something else out there that could be explored by the division.
And in the mule deer plan that Justin presented, it says we're going to look at investigate different alternate routes within that mule deer plan lifespan. And we're all willing at the division to investigate different alternatives.
Kevin.
And so right now we just want to address that one concern that's been addressed to us.
Okay,
Kevin.
And that would just be my comment is. You know, we can't vote tonight, but I would say I'm a lot more comfortable with the current plan the division's using than to change that and let the division in the new mule deer plan during that time frame if they would like to come out with something.
Kevin, can I read you this email here?
Yeah.
This is an email I just got this afternoon from Ben Louder, who's from the Utah Bowman's Association. He says, last week the Central Region RAC voted against the DWR proposal and passed an alternate solution instead. The alternate solution passed by the Central RAC is as follows. Process all first-choice applications first in order of highest to lowest preference point and by assigned random number within each preference point group. If an applicant obtains a tag in this first choice application round, then they lose their points. If a person does not obtain a tag in this round, then they gain a point. Then you process all remaining applications that were not successful in the first round, draw by assigned random number, upon evaluation of each remaining applicant, evaluate choices 2 through 5, issue the first available tag, no points awarded or lost in this round.
And I'd ask a question to Lindy about that.
I did not get that proposal at all from that conversation in Central. I talked to Ben on Monday, and he informed me of that's what he got out of Central, and that's not what the division got out of Central.
Okay.
Okay.
But, so that's the same thing that we did. And Ben's actually in with us, and that was from Carl Hurst into Central.
But that's not
our understanding of the proposal.
But that was not the division's understanding, so either I need to go back and read the minutes.
Okay.
Or, you know, actually talk to Carl personally and see what he was intending, but that's not what we got out of it.
Okay. And so just to clarify, so that proposal that is in the minutes will be what goes to the wildlife to vote on. So this would have to come through another rack to be a separate proposal.
In that detailed thing, it was not what I got out of the Central was do the limited entry, just kind of like what Troy said, do the limited entry, evaluate everyone's first choice first, and then evaluate everyone's second choice, and so forth. That to me is like the limited entry draw, where we evaluate everyone's first choice, doesn't matter what point category you're in. You just get a point for an application number for every point you have, and then so you could be waiting 6 years to draw on a general season tag.
Well,
someone with 0 points could draw.
So the difference to me is you've got to give, that's the preference points are different than bonus points. And preference points put you to the top of the line. If you have 4, your group, I mean, you should get your first choice there. I mean, and then before somebody with 0 points gets their first choice, right?
That was the design of the preference point system, yes.
Yeah.
Thoroughly confused, Mr. Chairman.
Tell me, it's taken me years to grasp the whole concept of everything.
Yeah, I'll bet. And any other comments from the rack?
I just have one. Was there a thing in here tonight that said we're going to do away with bonus and preference points and make them all similar? Did I hear that or not?
That's an idea in the mule deer plan that they're going to explore in the future. Okay. But that's not what's proposed tonight at all.
And that would come through a public process.
Yes,
right.
That would
still
be
but that's
big
out there.
Well, that'll be fun.
Yes. No other questions.
Can you spell entitlement? That'll be fun.
Any parting thoughts that you want to leave the Wildlife Board before we move on?
I would say that I prefer the system that's there now. It looks like it's working for the division on what they're trying to pursue, too.
Yeah, it's working really great for us, and it gets us the permits into the public's hands,
right,
in a fairly manner.
I'm with Chris and Carl. I don't know what, I don't see the necessity to change it.
If any changes are made to address the concerns, I think it's critical that Troy's point that families and youth opportunities don't get flushed in the new system. That whatever system they come up with keeps that fact in mind.
Thank you.
Thank you.
CWMU, Scott.
Thank you. I'm Scott McFarland. I'm the Private Lands Public Wildlife Coordinator for the Division. And this evening I will be presenting the 2015 Buck and Bull CWMU and Landowner Association recommendations. There we go. Every year we receive basically three types of applications that we act on. We have new applications for the CWMUs, which are that just brand new ones, or CWMUs that have changed land ownership or property boundaries or added or subtracted acreage is more than 34%. And they fall in that new category, and we'll talk about some of those tonight. Renewal applications are, all our CWMUs are on 3-year renewal cycles, so they're approved for their to operate their CWMUs for 3-year cycles unless they change, and that they have the ability to change. It can be initiated by the division or the CWMU to request changes. The things that require board action on the changes are any changes in permit numbers, changes in permit allocation or the public-private ratio of permits, or any change in season dates. So this year we received 17 new applications. Four of those were due to land ownership changes that were greater than 34%, where they increased or decreased their acreage. 13 brand new applications, and we have one application that we received, and the division has recommended denial of that one. We had 82 CWMUs submitted renewal applications for 2015 to 2017. Three CWMUs submitted change applications requiring RAC or board approval, and two CWMUs did not reapply and drop from the program. So a total of 129 applications were submitted for the 2015 hunting season. So. As an overview for 2015, if everything is based on our approval numbers, there would be 129 CWMUs statewide. That's up from 117 from 2014 this year. Just a breakdown on region, the northern region has the lion's share of those at 76 CWMUs, northeastern 6, central is 13, southeastern has 19. Southern region has 14 CWMUs, and what this represents is over 2.26 million acres that are enrolled in the CWMU program, and that of that 96.5% of all the acreage enrolled is private land. There's over 606 private landowners that participate in the CWMU program. For permit recommendations, and this is general for all the CWMUs, if approved, there would be 1,992 private buck deer permits and 264 public buck deer permits. For management buck deer, there would be two private, one public permit. Bull elk, 931 private permits, 140 public permits. Buck pronghorn, 89 private permits, 65 public permits. And bull moose would be 43 private permits and 41 public permits, for a total of 3,051 permits that would go to the CWMUs, 3,057 permits would go to the CWMUs, and 511 or 16.7% would go to the public through the draw. So I'll go through the recommendations by region. There's so many of these that you received in your RAC packet. A couple of sheets on the CWMUs. One shows the CWMUs with all their recommended permits. And that packet is just what was the one sheet that has the recommended permits on there is just for the ones that require the renewals or new CWMUs that require action by the RAC and the board. And then the other paper that you received was shows all the permits we received applications for, and those are the rule requires that we identify any changes from their last application on the renewals, and so the changes are identified on that sheet. So I'm not going to read all through those, but there's some of them that do require action that I'll highlight. So the northern region first, they had 8 new applications, 2 of those because they decreased acres. And then 6 of those were brand new applications, and the division recommends approval of all of those. There's quite a few of these. The northern region renewal applications, these are ones that are at the end of their 3-year application period and applied again for another 3 years. The changes are noted on there, and the division recommends approval of all of these on this page. What I've done is I've highlighted in yellow all the CWMUs that have requested an extended bull elk season variance. Most of these have been granted in the past, but I've just highlighted these because they do request a bull elk season variance. They go anywhere from September 1st to November 30th on their range on there, but I won't read through all those, but that's what the yellow is on there. These northern regions renewal applications again continued. Recommend approval of all these. More northern region renewal applications and the bull elk season variance request for State Corner there. And the last of them, and Weber Florence Creek also requested a bull elk season variance. Their change applications, some of these do not require RAC and Board approval, but I put them in there as informational because there's some pretty significant changes. The Grass Creek CWMU is requesting a change the name to Riverview Ranch LLC CWMU. And Junction Valley added 6,000, it was almost the 34%, added 6,641 acres. Pine Canyon has requested an increase of buck deer permits from 20 to 30 with the corresponding splits. And the Woodruff Creek South, this is an action item. The division recommends deny unless recommended by the CWMU Advisory Committee. We were not able to get the committee together until this morning. We did have a meeting that addressed a variance that was to address a non-contiguous acreage request that they had. The committee met, and the recommendation was to accept or recommend that the variance be granted to the Woodruff Creek CWMU with certain conditions. This year is the first year of their three-year management plan, so they recommended that they, because it has already been in the CWMU, it's an important piece of property that they have, that it be the variance be granted, that they use that as a non-contiguous piece through the end of their three-year, so they'd have another 2 years that they could use that and give them time to make that contiguous again. So that was the recommendation from the advisory committee. Southeastern new applications, it's this region here. We have four new CWMU applications, Emma Park, Indian Head, Jump Creek, needs some special consideration as it's part of the Schofield East, the old Schofield East CWMU part that split off. It's under acreage for elk. It's an elk CWMU, recommended elk CWMU. It's been through the process. It's been through the CWMU Advisory Committee, and the Advisory Committee recommended approval with certain conditions. And what those conditions would be. The CWMU Advisory Committee spends quite a lot of time discussing these. They have representatives from the division make recommendations, from the landowners that come in and plead their case. And I mean, it's not taken really lightly. It's a very in-depth review of this. And what the CWMU Advisory Committee recommended that they approve it, but they have a three-year time frame to achieve the acreage minimum. If unable, the CWMU must return to apply for another variance by February 2016. And the CWMU must maintain a satisfaction rating on bull elk harvest of a minimum of 4, and that's on a scale of 1 to 5, and an antlerless harvest of 3. And they must have in the management plan to maintain an antlerless harvest success of a minimum of 15%. Was the recommendations from the committee. Okay, the Southeastern Region Renewal Applications, again, I won't read these. The Hiawatha is requesting a bull elk season variance from September 1st to November 30th. And the division recommends approval of all these. And the end of the new renewal applications for the Southeastern Region. Okay, Southern Region new applications. These are a couple of action items. This has changed since the presentation was put together, but East Zion is a new, they've applied for a new CWMU. They were including a section of state land that did not qualify under our rule to make up their minimum acreage and make their the CWMU contiguous. And so without the state section that they come up under acreage, it'd be more than the 40, it'd be less acreage than the 4,945 acres because of the non-contiguous nature of the property. And the division recommends denial of that because the property does not qualify under our rule. Milford East Bench, this is a change. We recommend approval of that, but they withdrew the application because of some, we recommend denial of that, but they've since have withdrawn their application. So that one's not in there anymore. So Southern Region Renewal Applications, bull elk season variances are highlighted in yellow there. We recommend approval of all those. And Central Region has one new application. It's the Crab Creek. It's a new, it was previously, the last time it was a CWMU was in 2010. It's 10,200 acre deer and elk CWMU. The division recommends approval of that one. And the renewal applications are such, we recommend approval of all of these. And they have one change application, and we have to do this in this meeting, even though it's bucks and bulls. It does affect their management plan for, they requested a decrease in their turkey permits on the Deer Creek CWMU from 8 to 4, and that's a 50-50 split, public-private. So it'd be 2 to the public, 2 to the CWMU. And the division recommends approval of that one. Northeastern Region, new applications. There's Moon Ranch and Sand Creek. We recommend approval of both of those. Northeastern Region renewal applications, there's only 4 of them. Recommend approval of all of those. Since you're not voting tonight, if you would like, I will just keep on going through the Landowner Association recommendations, and then you can have questions, discussions on both of those if you would prefer to do it that way, or I can separate them.
No, I think that's fine.
Okay. I'll go through with the Landowner Association voucher recommendations for 2015. We received 15 applications for 2015 season. The division recommends approval of 12 as received. We have 2 split recommendations and 1 recommendation to deny the application. So a total, and I'll go through those. A total of 15 landowner associations, if all are approved, we'd have 116 deer vouchers, 1 management buck voucher, 7 elk vouchers, and 8 pronghorn vouchers. The reason I specify these as vouchers is that's how the landowner association receives a voucher and they redeem them for a permit. So the split recommendations. The Panguitch Lake Landowner Association requested 10. The way that these permits are allocated to the Landowner Association is a percentage based on acreage enrolled in the Landowner Association compared with the habitat on the entire limited entry unit. So they only qualify for 7 using that formula, and they requested 10, but they only qualify for 7. The Vernon Landowner Association every year request 35. I believe that's because that's how many landowner association members they have. But it has varied. Some years we've actually given them more than they've requested. 2 years ago we did. For 2014 it was, I believe, 28. And this year they qualify for 30. And so the division's recommended that they have 30. And then the Pilot Mountain Landowner Association is in Box Elder County. This would be a new landowner association. They've worked really hard to try and put together a landowner association to qualify for one permit every year, and that's what their request is. And I think in your RAC packet you've had a variance requesting from them what they qualify for. And the 0.22 is a little bit, it's not correct. It'd be 2.25 or a quarter of a permit a year. The CWA or the landowner associations are on 3 year, similar to the CWMUs are on 3 year renewal basis now. So we look at them as on a 3 year average, and they would qualify for three quarters of a permit over the 3 year period. They're requesting, they said that they couldn't live with the one permit every 3 years. And so, we recommend the denial of that. But they did request a variance to allow one permit every year. I believe that request will go to the Wildlife Board on December 1st. So, and with that, that's all for the Landowner Association and CWMUs. Thank you.
Thanks, Scott. From the RAC.
On the Emma Park CWMU, you showed a new Emma Park CWMU. So we got two CWMUs called Emma Park now, or?
Well, we have the old Emma Park CWMU and the Indian Head CWMU, which is split off from the old Emma Park CWMU. Oh, okay. So we only
Indian
have
Indian Head is the name of the new one.
Right. The Indian Head is the name of the new one. Yeah, it was previously one CWMU split into two with two different names. Okay. So Emma Park is, they've retained that name. So. Yeah, I hope we don't have two CWMUs of the same name. that would cause problems. So.
How many landowners are in that Pilot Mountain Landowner Association?
Off the top of my head, I think there's about a dozen. So.
And is the private land on Pilot Mountain a critical component of elk habitat?
Yes and no. Okay, let me explain that. The private land consists mostly of croplands, and the major portion of it consists of croplands, and there's some crop depredation issues there that the landowner association is willing to concede to for a permit every year. I think that was written in the variance request there. As far as being critical, if we remove the croplands for it, the reason that the animal's there is because it's the only green thing on the mountain. Probably the population wouldn't change much if the croplands weren't there. It's just that's where the elk like to go because it's the best feed. It's the greenest thing. And it's the only green thing around Pilot Mountain for certain times of year. So,
it just seems like one elk tag a year is kind of minimal, and if it solves some damage concerns, then it seems like a variance would be in order. But
yeah, there's only three permits available to the public. This is a shared unit between Nevada and Utah. Nevada has three permits. They're talking about in the future of increasing those number of permits, which would probably increase their percentage that they could get. But right now, there's only three permits for the Utah side, so they'd be taking one permit.
Is that managed on a 5-6-year-old? Or?
I believe so, yeah. It's quite a high age management objective on that. So it's a trophy quality limited entry elk unit.
I
Questions from the audience? Comments from the audience? Comments from the rack? I got a call on the jump creek today, and so that recommendations from the committee, but before I go tonight, I'll write those down. So if I get that okay. call, but
sure.
Any comments?
None.
Okay. Before you adjourn, I'd like 3 minutes of Rack's time for non-related issue.
Okay.
Let's see, you got one more. Where is that?
Yeah, we have another.
I think you did them together.
Well, I've got one more agenda item.
Okay.
And that's the landowner permit rule change.
Yeah. You got to do 10 minutes.
Oh, okay.
I did those together. I promise next time I'll separate the CWMU's and Landowner Association.
Okay.
So, did you want to go to that agenda item?
Yeah.
Right now? Okay. The next thing I'll address this evening is some proposed changes to the landowner permit rule, R657-43, the main thing being the establishing of a landowner appreciation permit. We've got basically four major things that we're changing here. One's not so major. The clerical changes, we've just changed some of the wording. For example, using unit instead of region and eligible property instead of private lands. So that's one change that went through the rule. Another major changes, and probably the biggest thing, is the creation of a landowner appreciation permit. Another change we did was some clarification regarding public access on private property for limited entry landowner permits. And we did some changes on the permit calculation, some clarifications on the permit calculation process for limited entry landowner permits. And one other change that came along with that was creating a new bookkeeping requirement for landowner associations for documenting public access. To begin with, it'd probably be easiest if I read, this is right from the rule, the intent of the landowner appreciation permit. As it's been said throughout the night here, this is recognizing the contribution that private property, private landowners make to our wildlife resources, our big game animals in the state. I know it's been said, we have an exact calculation, but over half of our winter ranges occur on private lands throughout the state. So they do have a significant contribution to our wildlife resource. The intent of the landowner appreciation permit is to provide an opportunity for landowners and their immediate family whose property provides habitat for migratory deer to purchase a general deer permit for the general unit hunt boundary where the landowner's property is located. Okay, that was the intent of it. There's areas in the state where private property provides substantial contribution to deer populations in helping meet our management objectives. Some of these private lands don't meet the requirements for a general landowner permit, but are critical for migratory deer. Currently, we have in the landowner permit rule that allows landowners to qualify for a general season landowner permit. It requires that they have at least 640 acres to qualify for that permit. They can qualify for one permit for every 640 acres of habitat that they have. This is going above and beyond that and creating a landowner appreciation permit for smaller landowners, and I'll explain how that works. But it's also to provide an opportunity for these landowners to purchase general season deer permit to hunt the applicable general season unit. So the first thing I will go into is the qualifications for this landowner appreciation permit. It's for private lands only. It's for landowners and immediate family only, no lessees. On the other program with the general season landowner permit, lessees are allowed, but this one isn't. They have to have a minimum of 100 acres of cultivated land and mechanically harvested croplands. Property has to provide habitat for migratory deer. We didn't want to encourage resident deer populations, so this would be for migratory deer. They may have both, but that was one of the purposes of it. And the DWR will establish a map showing crucial corridors for the herd meeting management objectives. It's going to be up to the discretion of the division and the regions to sort these out, which ones qualify for this. There'll be locational requirement, land characteristics, land ownership requirements, and other qualifying factors with that. The specifics of the landowner appreciation permit, the applications are available May 1st. Applicant chooses a general season deer hunt, whether it be archery, muzzleloader, or general season rifle. They're on a first-come, first-served basis based on the application date when they're turned into the regions. The successful applicants are ineligible for general landowner permit program and vice versa. So what this does is it creates two programs. There's the 640-acre requirement or the 100-acre requirement, but they have to choose which one they want to get into. There's only one permit per eligible property and per landowner. There's no vouchers, and we're developing recommendations where the numbers will come from this in the spring meeting when the numbers are determined for each of the wildlife management units in the state for deer. The permits will be in addition to the annual cap, but they're not to exceed 2% of the permits for each unit. So there will be, it's like I said, it's on a first come, first serve basis, and they don't exceed 2% of what's allocated to the unit. Okay, the second item on there, we're going away from the landowner appreciation permit, was a clarification that we made on public access, in the limited entry unit. Okay, so we did some modifications, some clarifications on this. It was being interpreted two ways, but for the purpose of the permit calculation, it's based on the lands enrolled in the landowner association, not just the private lands in the unit. There's some miscommunication that in order to qualify for a landowner association in a limited entry unit, the landowners had to take the entire amount of private land or habitat in the unit, and they have to enroll at least 51% just to qualify to be in a landowner association. Some of those were taking the entire private lands and applying those to be able to qualify for an increased number of permits on there, but it's the private lands that are enrolled in the landowner association to use the calculation. And if you need me to explain that, I can do that later. But so the other clarification was that the landowners receiving vouchers must allow an equivalent number of public hunters onto his or her private land for the limited entry unit. It was being misconstrued that all of the public hunters, you know, equivalent to the number of vouchers that the landowner association had, could go anywhere on the landowner association. We took this to the attorney's office, and they said this is the intent of the law here. It's what we wanted it to say anyway. So it goes from an individual, what the intent of it was to go on an individual basis. So for example, if a landowner received two vouchers and he redeemed those, he would be required to allow two of the public onto his personal property. And the reason we did that way is because if there's one piece of property in the association that had, by perception or reality, most of the deer or something, all of these would probably go to the one landowner, and it's just a way of being fair and distributing hunters through the landowner association. Landowner associations who handle distribution proceeds from the vouchers must provide public access to the members receiving the benefit. Okay, and access is on it as it's a when requested requested basis. And what this does is it also creates some bookkeeping obligations for the landowner associations. We want to make sure that the public is taken care of on these landowner association lands, and it's fair to them. So the landowner association is going to be required to document the members who receive the vouchers. They already have to give a distribution list with their application every year, but they have to document the members who receive the vouchers and the members of the public who request access to the private lands in which members provided access to those people. But this provides an avenue for the division to document public benefit of the landowner permit program. So with that, I'll take questions. Thank you.
Why in the first part of the presentation, instead of creating a whole separate program, why don't you just drop the acreage on the original one from 640 to 100?
It's a good question. We didn't want to drop the current program because what the current program does is allows them to be able to eligible for large animals to have multiple permits. This was a request several years ago to create something that incorporated the smaller landowners also. I think if we did, what you do is take away from the original program and with the eligibility for multiple permits. What this does is just creates an avenue, it's basically an appreciation permit for the smaller landowner that provide habitat for our deer. So, don't know if that explained that or not, but.
Kind of. I don't know.
It's an additional program because these permits are in addition to the ones that are already allocated for the landowner, the general season landowner.
So, permits. I mean, can you give me, I mean, 100 acres doesn't seem like a lot compared to 640. I can see a lot more landowners with 100 acres than I can with 640. So, I mean, how many permits are we talking about here?
Let me give you some examples here. Because we're recommending a 2% cap on these, I mean, it's not just unlimited permits. For example, if all the permits for all the units were redeemed statewide, there would be somewhere around 1,700 permits statewide that would be given out. But for example, on I don't have my glasses here. I think I can get it. Just give me a sec. For like Panguitch Lake, for example, they have for 2014 they had 3,200 permits, and that equates to 64 landowner appreciation permits would be the cap on that. On some of the smaller ones, the Dutton has only 650, so they'd have 13 permits.
I missed the 2% cap there.
Yeah,
sorry.
Okay. So yeah, it's not unlimited then. Fish Lake, Plateau Fish Lake, 1,300 permits allocated, so there would be 26 landowner permits cap on that. On first come, first serve basis, based on when they submit the application to the regions. So,
is that Kevin's backyard?
Huntington Canyon. Okay.
I told him it looks like my backyard.
Because of the deer or the background?
The clay hill mostly.
Oh, okay.
Not the deer?
Yeah. Oh.
Under your that last section you were talking about where the association has to give equal opportunity to the public as far as how many vouchers they receive, they have to allow that many public. Do you foresee it as the public's responsibility to figure out where they want to hunt and request and see if there's available slots left on that private land, or is it the private landowner's responsibility to solicit. I have room for three hunters, and contact hunters to come hunt their private land, or how does that work?
The only way that we can work this, and I think it's the way that's been done, is that they have to contact the landowner association president, who has a map of all the landowner association lands. If they have specific properties that they would like to hunt, they could request them. Otherwise, he would say, you know, this one, you know, you can hunt this, these, you know, these have all redeemed permits. Some of the properties will not have redeemed permits because they don't get permits every year. So it's going to be up to the landowner association president to be able to distribute these out. Currently we have no system of checks and balances because there's no bookkeeping requirements to them. If public complaints says like, yeah, they denied me access to this land and they redeemed permits, we don't have any avenue to even check that out. So what this does is it helps us document our benefit to the public on this and be able to address complaints also.
So as far as the checks and balances go, is the division going to annually go to the landowner association and say, okay, let's see the names of the hunters that you...
I would foresee that we would do that, and it's not required by rule, but they... We didn't put that in this time to say that we're going to check on this every year. This is more to address complaints if we had complaints that, you know, if the public felt that they're being treated unfairly on this. So, but right now they don't have to submit that. They have to submit a permit distribution plan every year with their applications, but they don't have to document this and provide it to us. And I imagine if that becomes a problem, then we would require it be provided, but not at this time.
It'll be interesting.
Yes, it will.
Questions from the audience? Comments, Garrett Hall?
Yeah, Garrett Hall with Utah Farm Bureau. I just wanted to speak in favor in support of the landowner appreciation tags. It's been mentioned several times the value that private land plays in habitat for these deer herds. And we at Farm Bureau just feel like this is a kind of a small way we can show some appreciation and hopefully some compensation to these landowners of critical feed and habitat. So I know you can't vote on anything tonight, but just wanted to voice my support and the support of the Farm Bureau for this program. So. Thank you.
Thank you, Garrett.
Yeah, thanks for staying.
thanks for staying.
There's probably only one benefit of not having a vote, and that would be our time we're going to end. Yeah.
There's more benefit than that. Brent doesn't have to try to translate all the motions.
Any other comment from the rack?
If we're done with the agenda part, I'd like to just take 2 minutes if you don't mind.
Do it.
This is the second meeting we've had without a quorum. Speaking for myself, I didn't receive any of the materials until I requested them, and it seems to me that and I know there's for everybody that's not here, there's probably a different reason that they're not here, but you know if it's because the email list is old or whatever, I think it would pay to do an email check, send everybody out saying, when you receive this email, call me, so that everybody knows that the email they've got is a legitimate one. The other thing is going to the electronic packets, I guess. You know, speaking again for myself, volunteer a lot of time, and it's hard. I don't have a laptop computer to bring the electronic material with me. So if I want to bring you the material to reference, I have to, you know, print it out at my expense on my printer, my paper, my ink. I would like to request that, and I know the mailing of the packets was probably what the killer as far as budget goes, because there was a big postage on some of that stuff. So if it would be possible to, you know, mail it to those that can't access it, that want it, that can't access it from a regional office, me where I'm close enough to regional office, if I could request the packets be printed out and I'd come pick them up from you guys, that would help me immensely. But I really think we need to, I don't know, try to get some enthusiasm back in our RAC members, because it's disappointing to me, and I assume you guys too, that we take our time to come here and we essentially can't do anything. When we didn't have a quorum tonight, I almost said, well, let's not even have a meeting, let's just go home. But that wouldn't be fair to the public that came tonight to express their views as well. So I don't know what the answer is, but I think there needs to be some more effort put out there to try to get the RAC members present or replace RAC members that are no longer interested or whatever it takes.
So a couple thoughts I had. Yeah, it's embarrassing from a chairman to go up to the Wildlife Board and say, well, yeah, we didn't have a quorum, and especially for this meeting being one of the most important meetings of the year, and to not have a quorum, it is really embarrassing. A couple thoughts that you brought up that I didn't think of is there a correlation with just going to paperless and with the email trail? Could there be some that are falling through the cracks and not getting that? I hadn't tied those two together, and I think we need to chase that down. The other thought I had was to get with Chris and those that haven't been here for an extended amount of time. I think a phone call is in order, and really chase that down. And if their heart's not in this right now, we need to get a quorum and get the process so that we do. So.
I mean, out of the five people that are here tonight, there's two of you guys are on the payroll while you're here. So I mean, there's three of us here essentially.
Thanks for your concerns, Darius, and I agree with you. I think there's a few things we can do. I wish I could say that I think that the reason why people aren't here is because they haven't been getting an email to remind them. But I think there was a glitch where one or two of you didn't get the email. But I think the majority of the RAC, the 13 members, are getting the emails and are getting the reminder from Brent that says, if you can't make it, let me know. And out of the 13 members on the RAC, so there's five of you here, so there's eight not here. Out of those eight that aren't here, only two told us that they weren't going to be here. So I guess from those, so six people didn't tell us they weren't going to be here and aren't here. And some of those six haven't been, you know, been consistently not here. So we can definitely work and see if we can get those people replaced sooner rather than later, even in the next month or two, get them replaced or give them a call and see if there's still an interest and try to get them back engaged in the process. We can definitely print out, and maybe this week, we'll send everyone on the RAC an email, you said, Darius, confirming that this is a correct email and have them respond, but then also respond whether they would like the printed version of the RAC packets. It used to come from the Salt Lake office, and I think it just became a lot of work, and maybe they thought it was unnecessary work because they were sending out, you know, thousands and thousands of pages of RAC packets every month, and they thought most people were going electronic. But we can give you that option. If you're not going electronic, we out of the region. Okay.
And you know, read it at work when I had a break.
Yeah.
And I don't have Wi-Fi at work.
Yeah.
I don't have access.
So in the email this week, we'll ask you, would you like, and we can send you the rack packet from the region. Yeah. You can do that. But I appreciate your comments, and I agree. It is concerning that for 2 months in a row we haven't had a quorum. But I appreciate you being here, and Kevin did a great job last time. Even though we didn't have a formal motion and vote, he relayed the concerns and the comments. So I hope you don't feel like today was wasted. But you're right, we need a quorum.
Just out of curiosity, when we go to the Wildlife Board without a quorum, you know, without being able to vote on things, even though we're allowed to, you know, kind of express the general feeling, are we looked at, I mean, is that looked at less, you know, because it's not coming from a vote?
I don't want to let Chris answer that.
Is it my man? What, Mike? Mike, you have a
Dr. King.
I think it's
yeah, you go for it.
Well, I'm not sure how others view that. I personally, at the last meeting, was able to express what I had heard in the meeting and the board's general interests, and I would do that again in the upcoming meeting. And so, I mean, the opinions are getting out there, but obviously if it's not an official recommendation coming from the RAC, it's going to be looked at in a lesser light, I would say.
I think, you know, we discussed
I'd like
the
to
summary
see
of the motions.
A quorum at the meetings, yeah.
I think, you know, saying an 8-0 vote in favor of something is pretty powerful, or it was a 4-5 split. You know, that actual voting, I think, goes a long way with the board members, so it's something we need to have.
And it's we're taken away from the public, because each one of us represents a section of the public out there, and if those people that aren't here representing their constituents, and they're cheating the public of Utah.
That's a good point.
Yeah. And it's just, well, yeah. I'm just thinking of three people that are usually here. Wayne and Sue are usually here, and so is Trish. So hopefully this is a fluke, but there are RAC members we can go after that I haven't been here as consistently.
Yeah.
And the other one, I think, that with a phone call is the elected officials, and with that process going to be turning over, if those votes have been made and they're going to change who's on there, maybe we can do that sooner than later.
Yeah, that's true.
And elected officials, it's important to get an elected official that cares. I mean, they got lots of meetings to go to, and this one usually gets upended by something. What they feel is important. So it doesn't have to be a commissioner. It just has to be somebody that represents a public entity. So if there's somebody in the county or something that has the interest, it will show up. I think it's important.
I don't know if they care about wildlife, but for the first time in a long time, there's a county commissioner from Green River, so he wouldn't have to drive very far if they...
Man, we don't have a quorum, we go knock on his door.
Yeah.
But good points, and thanks for bringing those up, and thanks for being here.